Good morning and welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. Having said that, I want to remind everybody you can always donate to the station to keep us rolling. We did a great job. We had wonderful support from the listeners in our fundraising. And it's if you like, personally, you can do it year-round, CIUT.FM, donate. We're going to be talking to Isaac Saney, who is a teacher Dalhousie. He is an authority on Cuba. He's written books about Cuba, traveled there many times, and is one of the people that we can rely on for up-to-date information about developments with Cuba and its famous neighbor to the north, Donald Trump. There is a, to my mind, a kind of artificial crisis being created. There's a real one, but there's also the problem of media joining in and trying to create stories to alarm people. I believe we're joined now by Isaac Saney. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. Hey, how are you today, sir?
Very good. Great to be talking to you. I know you've been very busy around this issue of the increased pressure from the United States against Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
People across, I think, across the world, but certainly in Canada, United States, people who know of the accomplishments of the Cuban Revolution and particularly its ability to stand up as a sovereign country against the greatest power, the most dangerous power on earth, the United States, understand that there's a developing, really a crisis that the U.S. seems to be determined to try to turn that Cuban Revolution around. Can you tell us where we are right now? What is this situation?
Well, I think we're in a period of unprecedented U.S. Hyper-escalation, hyper-imperial aggression, whichever term we wish to use. People can argue about the accuracy of these things. But it seems that the United States has imposed sanctions and, you know, they've all been internationally condemned in ways, new ways that many people didn't anticipate. So their goal is specifically to starve the Cuban people. It's a form, as some people have said, a form of slow genocide, right? Mm-hmm. So Cuba right now is on an entire oil and fuel blockade the United States is imposing. This is having a significant impact on the people's lives. There are huge blackouts in Cuba, what they call apagones, without electricity. The impacts on the hospital, on healthcare, and so forth. It's quite evident. And what's interesting is that obviously people support this policy within U.S. ruling circles, some of them are very clear what this is about. This is about starving the Cuban people into submission. And it has been internationally condemned, but the point is to translate that, those international condemnations, this public consciousness in support of Cuba and against U.S. aggression into an actual movement that can defeat the U.S. economic war against Cuba. And that's what it can be described as, an economic war against the Cuban people, designed to starve them into submission, designed to return Cuba into basically the U.S. fold, in a sense, under U.S. tutelage and subjugation and domination. And, you know, in fact, I'll make one last point here. You know, this war against Cuba has been ongoing for well over 65 years. There's a memorandum, an infamous memorandum from Lester B. Mallory, who was a very important person in U.S. State Department, very important in inter-American affairs. And on April 6, 1960, he penned a memorandum, you know, where he basically acknowledged that the only way, in a sense, and I'm paraphrasing, but you could find this memorandum online, the only way to bring down the Cuban government was basically to deny it all the stuff it would need, economically asphyxiated, cut it off from the rest of the world, to generate starvation, desperation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And hopelessness. That is the goal. And what's important as well is also, given the challenges that U.S. imperialism faces globally, right?
Yes.
You know, people often talk about the U.S. empire in decline, the rise of new powers, they talk about multipolarity and so forth. Cuba is also part and parcel of this. And so any country that sort of exercises any form of independence in the Americas, right, is seen as the unforgivable example to the United States. And of course, Cuba, which has resisted for nearly 70 years, the U.S. imperial might, okay, is now vindictively being targeted as an example. And not only for its independence, but as you pointed out in your initial comments, you know, Cuba represents an alternative to how we can organize a society. I mean, it's not a perfect society. It has its ups and downs, as everybody knows. But it represents a profound inspiration, right, in terms of using the resources of a country to benefit its people. Universal health care, education, social security, and, of course, the incredible internationalist programs that Cuba has provided across the world. Over 600,000 Cubans have served in over 160,000 countries. 600,000 doctors in over 160 countries providing, fortification against all sorts of diseases and so forth, increasing the well-being of people's lives. This is the unforgivable example that the United States seeks to destroy.
Yeah. By the way, we're speaking to Isaac Seney, Dalhousie University, and he has, you wrote a book which really underlines this international impact of Cuba, because people forget the great role played by Cuba in the defeat of apartheid in South Africa.
That's forgotten, as you point out. And in Canada, we have the myth of Mulroney, where he basically takes credit, right, for bringing down the apartheid regime. You know,
fighters in Angola.
Yeah. Well, you know, people know the story, but I mean, people know, there's a whole history of the struggle against Portuguese colonialism in Southern Africa, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, in West Africa and Guinea-Bissau. And the Portuguese had the longest presence in Africa, right? And perhaps, you know, some people argue, because you don't want to have a hierarchy of good colonialists and bad colonialists, but they were particularly horrible, right?
Yeah.
And you know, when Angola, for example, Mozambique, particularly Angola, was gaining independence from Portugal, right? And there was going to be a black-led government on the borders of Namibia, which was illegally occupied by the racist South African government. One of the things that actually happens is that, you know, the South Africans, with the support of the United States, invades Angola, trying to reduce it to being a puppet state. And in the midst of trying to extinguish Angolan independence, the Cubans are asked by the Angolan government, right, to assist. And in fact, the Angolan government issued an international SOS.
Yeah.
But they made a specific request for the Cubans, and the Cubans responded and inflicted the first major defeat on the South Africans, right, shattering the myth of white invincibility, and as well as, contributing to African liberation. And this all comes to a culmination point. I don't want to make it too much of a long story, but in 1987-88, there was a critical series of battles around a town called Cuito Cuanavalo, and then eventually on the southern borders of Angola and Namibia, that changed the balance of power in the region. And the Cubans played a decisive and critical role in those engagements, both in terms of providing the soldiers, the personnel, the military equipment, but also as well as the strategic guidance that altered the balance of power in the region and eventually led to the independence of Namibia, accelerated the collapse of apartheid, and Mandela himself acknowledged this many times. In fact, there's a famous speech where he says, the Cuban internationalists, have an unparalleled legacy of providing selfless internationalism to Cuba. He said this in many different ways. And Cuba is often described as the only country to have come to Africa and gone away with nothing but the coffins of its sons and daughters who died in the struggles to liberate Africa. And in one sense, my last point on this is that Cuba is probably the only country that has truly valorized African life, treated them as human beings, right, by making Africa an explicit area of focus for its foreign policy.
Just phenomenal, actually. If people want to know the motives of U.S. imperialism, it's like they are keeping score. They know they've been defeated by Fidelismo in many quarters. And it's a phenomenon that now they want to, of course, boil it down to a news story that an artificial one completely. And I want to ask you about that. They seem to have created a model now of criminalization of political leaders. Instead of dealing with a political leader, a historical phenomenon between states and people, they reduce it to, he's a drug dealer. He shot down an American plane. They want to go after, they seem to be wanting to try to create a situation like they did with Venezuela, where the Venezuelan president was kidnapped out of his own country.
Yeah. Well, yeah, what they're attempting to do, obviously, is destroy international law. You know, some people may argue international law was a weak shield, but it embodied principles from the United Nations Charter, and of course, the gains that were made, not only after the Second World War, the great anti-fascist struggle, but also during the anti-colonial movements. There were spaces of international law, at least symbolically, that were expanded. And the United States seeks to destroy that, basically to make might is right, the only principle that matters, that those who have the greatest imperial might can impose their will anywhere else. And then they begin to manufacture a whole variety of specious excuses by criminalizing leaders so they can then intervene. And I think everybody all knows this very clearly, that this is nothing to do with specifically anything around so-called democracy, so-called human rights, so-called anything around fighting drugs or anything else. It's these are specious manufactured excuses to justify naked brute force to seize the resources and extinguish the independence and right of self-determinations of peoples. Mm-hmm. And I encourage people to go and read perhaps the most perused national security document ever produced by any U.S. government, which is the 2025 national security document produced by Trump. And it's quite open. There's no euphemisms. There's no fig leaves. There's no hiding the pretext. It's very clear that they claim the Americas as their sole preserve to control. And also, they actually make it very clear that they will intervene in countries and determine who is in power in those countries. And so this is what Cuba represents. Cuba represents, and Venezuela also, of course, heavily sanctioned, represents unacceptable challenges, not only to the U.S. Imperial dictate, but also we're representing in many ways alternatives, right, to the kind of societies people are living in. I mean, the United States is in crisis. When you look at and you read the stuff about, you know, people who are just barely surviving, the level of economic insecurity, the level of violence in that society. You know, Cuba represents an alternative. They represent the possibility to radically imagine a new society. So there's not only hope, but it's also a concrete society that despite living under siege, and I stress this, and it's important, I think, for listeners to understand, every emancipatory project, every attempt to build a socialist project, a socialist alternative, has emerged under siege, right? And if Cuba was a failed state, as the United States likes to say, why are they investing so much resources, right, in trying to bring this state down, okay? and at the same time, while Cuba's been under the siege, healthcare, universal education, among other things, are provided for the population in the midst of an unprecedented siege that is, you know, genocidal in its very nature.
Yeah, I can remember when Michael Moore went to, he hired a ship and tried to go to Cuba so that for medical care, because they have universal medical care, and he had, he had veterans, military veterans who couldn't get care. And what it was brilliant propaganda, frankly. He simply showed this is a society that cares about every last person in it.
Yeah, and I should add a point here. There's actually doctors right now, as we speak in 2026, who are taking their patients who are suffering from various stages of Alzheimer's and dementia for treatment in Cuba called Neuroclim, right? There's actually a document you can find online, and it has tremendous results in helping to not only, stop the progress of the disease, but also make tremendous progress in that, okay? Mm-hmm. So what's actually happening is that, you know, Cuba has so much more to offer as well in terms of its biotech. It's an example of trying to combat climate change. It has a plan for 2100, among other things as well, right?
Yes.
In terms of, you know, trying to create a society, you know, in which everyone is, you know, valued as a human being. I mean, in Cuba, for example, you know, the vulnerable populations are not criminalized, right, as happens here. They're embraced, and the Cubans say, we must find ways to end their vulnerability, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this is important. I mean, it's also important to understand that, you know, Cuba is trying to fulfill, you know, sort of the aspiration that that was articulated by Jose Marti, who led this the necessary war, which is, in a sense, Cuba's war of independence from 1895 to 1898. And he envisioned a Cuba with all and with all for the well-being of all, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so forth. So this is the kind of society Cuba is trying to create. This is the kind of society I think all of us, all ordinary people, the vast majority of humanity aspires for, a society in which the resources are used for the benefit of its peoples instead of feeding a parasitic financial oligarchy, often referred to as the billionaire class. You know, as Bob Marley said, you know, in his song, So Much Trouble in the World, they blast off in their rocket ships, right? And no care for me, no care for I, no care for you, right? Okay, yes. a billion miles from reality. So we're talking about creating a world fit for humanity.
Yes. We're speaking to Isaac Saini, and he's has wonderful books on Cuba. I hope people will. Now is the time to be reading them.
I'd also encourage them to read Helen Yaffe's book, you know, We Are Cuba, which I think is an excellent book as well. Excellent book.
Who's that author again?
Helen Yaffe. She's a professor at the University of Glasgow. Mm-hmm. Okay, and she's written a brilliant book, We Are Cuba.
Yeah. By the way, Cuba has been so powerful. Again, you always have to consider 90 miles away from the heart of darkness, you might say, Washington, D.C. And they've managed brilliantly. I want to ask if you could tell us about this case that Rubio tries to make. Who were this brothers flying outfit?
This brothers rescue were comprised of people who were members of various terrorist groups, right? And basically, they had violated Cuban airspace well over 20 times, right? And the Cubans had warned the United States government that no government can tolerate people flying in from another country and violating illegally their airspace, particularly a group that had members who had been members who had previously been part of various terrorist groups. And you know, like people may know that you know there's been various terrorist acts that have been launched against Cuba from U.S. territory with the complicity, knowledge, and often assistance of the CIA and other agencies in the United States. You know, thousands of Cubans have been killed and injured as a result of these terrorist acts. So, Brothers to the Rescue isn't this innocuous, group that's involved in flying over and dropping leaflets and rescuing people. You know, these people were deeply implicated in being tied to various other terrorist groups, and they were violating Cuban airspace, right?
Yeah.
Repeatedly. Over 20-something times, and the Cubans warned them repeatedly, sent messages to the U.S. government, sent formal diplomatic notes, and eventually a message was sent via the Nobel Prize winner in literature, Gabriela Garcia Marquez, to President Clinton at the time, right, from the Cuban government, from Fidel Castro personally, warning them that, you know, that no country would tolerate this. Could you imagine Canada or the United States having planes flying illegally over their airspace and over the capital city? They'd be shot down,
not.
Right?
I mean, absolutely.
Yeah, and not just one plane doing that just once would be shot down. The Cubans allowed this to happen over 20-something times and warned the United States government. So eventually, two of the planes were shot down over Cuban territorial water, and then this was used as a pretext by the most vicious anti-Cuban members of Congress to put in place what's called the Helms-Burton Bill to further deepen the U.S. economic war against Cuba. It's specious. It's manufactured. You have people like, you know, in the U.S., like Colonel Wilkerson and other people understanding what was taking place. And even here in Canada, the Canadian ambassador to Cuba at the time, Mark Entwistle, has said very clearly, he said, listen, people need to understand the context of these terrorist attacks against Cuba to understand why those planes were shut down, the repeated violations of Cuban airspace, which were unacceptable, right? So this is a specious excuse manufactured by Marco Rubio to basically further deepen the economic war against Cuba and to prepare the grounds for military aggression, okay? But also it's a mark of desperation. The Cuban revolution has demonstrated tremendous resilience, innovation, and ingenuity in surviving this unprecedented economic onslaught. And so Rubio is becoming even more desperate. He just recently, a few days ago, basically sanctioned various other Cuban institutions, particularly the Cuban Institute for Friendship with the Peoples, which makes people like myself, yourself, people in the United States, sanctioned and criminal in the eyes of the U.S. government for challenging the unacceptable, criminal, immoral, horrific, horrendous, I could call it all sorts of epithets, U.S. policy against Cuba. It's genocidal, and it's unacceptable, and the international world stands against it.
Yeah, and look at how Canadians, by the way, Canadians are proud of the fact that they maintain relations. Canada has maintained relations to Cuba, and Canadians like to travel to Cuba. And now that's being interfered with, and we're supposed to accept that. It's clear the Canadian population, that's sort of one of the little badges of pride. Our medical system is one of them, but also the fact that, we in wintertime, we go to Cuba. And U.S. wants to cut off any positive thoughts apropos of Cuba.
Yeah, they do. I mean, in fact, you know, the U.S. is attempting to do that. They're basically trying to strangle Canada's relationship with Cuba. But we must not also absolve the Canadian government. They've been complicit in this, I would argue. They've done nothing to oppose this, nothing to stand up for Canadian sovereignty and self-determination, right? They've been extremely quiet. They haven't condemned the U.S. economic war against Cuba. They haven't condemned these latest aggressions against Cuba. They've cut flights to, they haven't done anything. They've cut flights from Canada to Cuba. They haven't done anything to defend, you know, these various companies that have tourist investments or interests in Cuba. Sherritt International, which was the largest foreign investor in Cuba, which is a Canadian company, you know, when the latest sanctions came down, Sherritt was going to suspend its operations, board of directors resigned, and eventually what they did was they ended up being a majority share, ended up being sold to a Trump advisor. Where has the Canadian government been in defending not just Cuba, but defending Canadian interests, right?
Well,
okay? Because this is a direct assault on Canada. So Carney has been complicit in that. It's clear he's no ideological friend of socialism or what of Cuba. I mean, he's a former central banker, you know. So the issue is, where is Canada in this, the Canadian government of Ottawa? And as you pointed out, the vast majority of Canadians stand with Cuba. I mean, there were over a million Canadians used to visit Cuba, right?
I know Canadians of every political stripe who say, I really like Cuba. They feel safe. They love its beaches. They love the people.
Yeah. Yeah, and they love it, and in fact polls have come out that, you know, well, the majority of Canadians say Canada should provide Cuba with all the material assistance it needs, up to providing fuel and oil, regardless of what the United States does. Right? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This comes out time and time and time again, and Carney, in a sense, has ignored this. And in fact, in Canada, you know, there is a law called the Federal Extraterritorial Measures Act, specifically to deal with the fact that Canadian law whatever we may think about that law might be, it should be the operational law within the Canadian territory. And Canada has done nothing to implement that. And they've allowed the United States to run roughshod over Canadian interests in Cuba, business interests in Cuba. And of course, some people may ask, well, why should I care about a corporation? I mean, corporations, you know, they care about profit. They don't care about the workers. What's progressive about defending them? But in this day and age, defending sovereignty and independence in the face of the imperial behemoth, the imperial monster, I think is incredibly progressive, right? So I think we need to call on the government in Ottawa. We need to call on Carney to do more for Cuba, to provide as much material assistance that they can provide, to protest against any aggression against Cuba that may come from the United States in terms of military attack, right? And to make a stand, because defending Cuba is defending Canadian sovereignty, defending Canadian independence and Canadian self-determination. And that is not some fantastical thought, you know, given Trump's 51st state rhetoric at one time about Canada, given the, you know, the fact that we know there are, you know, powerful U.S. interests who are trying to sort of stoke separatism, for example, in Alberta.
Yes. We're speaking to Isaac Saney, Dalhousie University, expert on Cuba. And on that point, it is impressive that now we have a leader of the New Democratic Party who says that we should be providing aid. I'm impressed that he didn't just say, well, we want international law, we don't want to see any trouble. No, he said, there's a blockade and we should be providing aid.
Yeah.
Pretty remarkable.
Yeah, he should be said that. And that actually came out as a result of the fact that there were conversations, right, between various Cuba solidarity activists and the NDP.
Yeah.
Particularly the Canadian Network on Cuba, which has become, you know, it's the umbrella organization for the solidarity movement in Canada, right? And so there was actually a conversation between a member of the executive and Avi Lewis that took place a couple of weeks ago, right? Specifically about this, okay?
A leader that actually listens.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. You know, the pressure, I mean, it's clear.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it's clear what's unfolding. This is genocidal. It's clear that if we allow this to unfold, right?
Yes.
Okay. What will happen?
Well, also, I think he hears the Canadian people who've always quietly been a supporter of Cuba because they see Cuba as a country that also, they feel themselves being pushed around by the U.S. Everyone admires someone who doesn't allow themselves to be pushed around.
Yeah. And people see, you know, in very simple terms, the United States is the big bully. And Canada sleeps next to the big bully, right?
They smiled every time Fidel gave a speech. Canadians would smile.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, Phil, you and I are old enough, in a sense, to remember that, you know, in the 60s and the 70s and 80s, yes. And I was young, I was very young back then, but I remember, you know, talking to people when I became politically active, that there was a strong movement for Canadian independence, right? That U.S. imperialism, yes. as much as the Canadian bourgeoisie or ruling class, right?
Yes.
Represented a threat to the Canadian people. Yes. And now we see it writ even larger than before, right?
Yes.
So here we have, you know, Carney is interesting. He's, you know, going off, you know, talking to China, talking to India, mm-hmm. you know, the rhetoric of a middle power. He gave
yes.
that infamous Davos speech, which I think people misinterpreted, right? Okay.
Absolutely.
He's not interested in international law
yes.
in a sense, as per se. He's interested in international law for what he called middle powers, right? But
yes.
at the same time, he's saying this. He's further integrating Canada into the U.S. military machine and
yes.
also calling for 60
yeah, he jumped to 5%. 5%
yeah.
of the budget.
Yeah, well, yeah, and he's expecting military spending, like they're talking something like military spending to go up by, what, $81 billion over the next few years, right?
Yes.
And cutting over $50 billion, probably even more, from the social services, right? The
yes.
attacks on unions, the attacks on collective bargaining, and the further concentration of power in, you know, in the cabinet, in the Privy Council, and in his person, where, for
yeah.
example, ministers are now allowed, and from what I understand, to fast-track projects that would normally not be fast-tracked because of the environmental implications, because of their, what they do in terms of violating indigenous rights, they can now do that as quickly as possible. That's what
yes.
he wants to do.
Yes.
So it's, you know, I think people had all sorts of illusions, and there's a lot of people, you know, in the face of Trump's threats, right, who gravitate towards somebody who seems to be speaking strong, the so-called elbows up.
Yes.
approach, right? You know, we have to think about, no, what kind of society do we want to build, right?
Yes.
Okay, we need to build a society, as you know, well, I think one that it's fit for human beings, where the resources are used for the well-being of human beings, not for the benefit of, you know, the oligarchy.
Yes.
And to get back to Cuba, Cuba's always represented that kind of society, even in the midst of this massive economic crisis that they
yes.
face, principally driven, overwhelmingly driven by the U.S. economic war, okay? The Cubans are attempting to spread the pain as evenly as possible and to involve people democratically and publicly in trying to solve these problems, to find solutions to them. And I make one point here. I think, you know, people often like to make these arguments that the economic crisis in Cuba is primarily the result of socialism, government mismanagement, and all this sort of stuff. But I always point out that when Obama, for tactical reasons, right, the goal of eliminating the Cuban Revolution still remained, but Obama adopted a different, perhaps more subtle, nuanced approach. So when the blockade or the economic war was lessened, just lessened to a certain degree, from 2014 to January of 2017, the Cuban economy grew. It flourished, right? And the same Cuban government, the same Cuban policies remained in place. And I think that's a very profound and poignant sort of indication of where Cuba's economic problems
yeah.
lie. I mean, that's not to say the Cubans don't have, you know, bureaucracy, inefficiencies, and so forth, right? They don't make missteps. Which country doesn't, okay? But
yeah.
the principal overwhelming cause of Cuba's economic issues is the U.S. economic war waged against it. And
yeah.
no country, I think, in the world would be able to survive what Cuba has been able to.
It's just phenomenal. When you
yeah.
see how they've been able to stand up, their resilience, you had a... the depth of it, the power of the,
yeah.
the revolution is such that the population understands what it's all about. They,
yeah.
they're not in the dark. Their leaders aren't kidding them.
Yeah.
And they can see the progress in their own lives. But I want to ask you. Oh, go
yeah.
ahead.
Now, I just want to say, and people who have left, I mean, people talk about the migration from Cuba, right, that's
mm-hmm.
taken place in the last few years because of the economic crisis. I mean, it's a regional phenomenon, migration from Latin America. And these people are primarily people who, not people who don't believe in the ideals of the revolution, but are dealing with the economic situation that they're living in, right? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important to understand as well. But in the midst of this crisis, especially since, you know, the attack on attack on Venezuela, the kidnapping of Maduro,
yes.
and the deepening of the sanctions in Cuba, Cuba has been incredibly innovative. There's been a massive move to introducing solar energy and other renewable sources into the Cuban energy grid, right? As
yes.
difficult as that may be, right, in the face of economic sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
And they've also found ways to refine
mm-hmm.
and use their heavy oil. They produce 40% of their oil, but it's a heavy oil, right?
Yes.
And now they've found a creative way to refine it so it can be used, right?
Yes.
So they're trying very creatively and innovatively to solve these problems. And even in the midst of that, they're developing in the biotech industry new drugs, right?
Yes.
One for cancer, for example, the vaccine that just recently came out. And I mentioned already in a previous comment on this interview, the NeuroClim, which is has incredible results in treating Alzheimer's and dementia. And we know that's an increasing concern in North America with an aging population.
Yes. Phenomenal. One last question, because it's today's headlines. I read that Mexico and Belize have shipments have arrived in Cuba.
Yeah.
Tell us about the Mexico-Belize business. And this, that's a tremendous courage, in my opinion, on the part of Mexico, and it's going to be a tight squeeze.
Yeah, well, there's a tremendous amount of pressure on President Sheinbaum of Mexico, and of course in Belize. The U.S. has attempted in Latin America, and particularly in the Caribbean, right, to sort of impose its will, to shatter the unity, right?
Yes.
So I was just recently in Jamaica, for example, for the 50th Anniversary Caribbean Studies Association Conference, had a very powerful meeting with P.J. Patterson, the former president of Jamaica from 1992 to 2006, and we spoke about these issues in Latin America, right? The courage it takes in Latin American Caribbean to stand and the Caribbean to stand up to the United States, right? So
yes.
While the English-speaking Caribbean, a lot of the countries have caved in, right, because of U.S. pressures, economic threats, cutting visas and so forth, the vast majority of the people support Cuba, see Cuba as part of the family, and also understand what Cuba has done for the region in terms of providing doctors, right? Okay.
Yes.
You know, the impact that's had on, you know, huge sections of the population, the scholarships and training that it's provided as well. Okay. So that all of that has become, you know, something that has really moved and mobilized public opinion. And so Belize and Mexico are really being extremely brave in terms of providing this. What Mexico, I hope, will do is provide oil to Cuba, which is madly needed in Cuba. I mean, in fact, only one shipment of oil has come into Cuba in the last 6 months or so, right? And
wow.
You can imagine the impact in Cuban life. But providing humanitarian aid, I think, is extremely important, and it's a very powerful statement, and it demonstrates that, one, these governments understand what public opinion is saying in their countries, where the people stand, and it also shows what the international community says.
Yes.
Okay, the community understands that this is criminal, illegal, fundamentally an attack on international law. And of course, people understand that if the U.S. can do it to Cuba, they can do it to everyone. Sort of like because the genocide was able to be carried out by in Gaza, you know, it opened up the floodgates. And
absolutely.
If the United States is able to starve an entire country,
an international
into submission,
issue.
Yeah, it becomes an international issue. Who's next?
Yes.
Yeah.
Isaac Saini, it's great to talk to you. You're master of all these topics, so we need to talk to you further. We're going to keep track of this issue. Thank you very much for joining us.
I appreciate you, and you know, you probably heard my little girl. I'm actually in the children's hospital here in Halifax, and my little girl, who's doing much better.
Thank
you.
Recovering from
an asthma attack, and so I hope you didn't hear too much of her in the background.
No, she's charming. We're glad she joined us. Thank you.
Yep.
Talk to you soon.
All the best. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Bye-bye. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT. Here's a little Cuban music, and then we'll be back with a Toronto legend in the peace movement, Ted Schmidt. And we'll talk to you soon.